Broadcasted live. Catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.
Welcome to Point of View. My name is Pimelo Modine. If you've been watching the US elections, you would know it's a brand new day in the US right now. In fact, geez, it's a brand new day for the world. Trump era is firmly back. And we all have to reckon with it. I think yesterday the story was a little different. I think none of us could call it. In fact, many, many analysts, were not sure. We weren't sure where this was going to go. And that's the big question. How come we were all so uncertain about where this is going to go? Executive Director of The City, a news outlet in New York, Nick Dawes, is on the line with us again this evening. Thank you so much for your time. Good evening and welcome, Nick. Gosh, so as I said, you know, yesterday we couldn't call it. Does that speak a little bit to our own prejudice, Nick, as the media, as polls, for instance, who got it so wrong again? Why do you think we were also, I suppose, I mean, not necessarily shocked, but a bit surprised?
So I would nuance that a little bit because the polls said that they couldn't call it, but that it could be quite a strong result one way or the other. And they also did say that people's top issue was the economy. So in some ways, I don't think the polling miss was as bad as it's been in years past. I think that, you know, journalists, pundits, the professional class all probably anchored a little bit in their own thinking models and maybe also hopes, kind of wanted to read those polls in a direction that confirmed some of their prior convictions and really struggled with the idea that someone so norm-shattering and in many ways so appalling could win. Even though in pretty much every other country that's had an election, you know, in the post-COVID inflation surge world has had a similar outcome.
Yeah. In fact, the world has gone quite right, has it not? And perhaps it speaks to a world that sometimes struggles winning economies. So, yes, everybody speaks about how the U.S. economy right now is quite strong, but there was a disconnect between the economy, as the country's economy, and people's lived experiences, people's daily life experiences of how expensive things are and the cost of living. And I don't think the Democrats were able to translate that to say, yes, our economy is doing well. Why is it that you're experiencing that food is more expensive, and when are you going to start feeling that inflation kind of come down in your own lived experience?
You and I talked about this a little bit yesterday, exactly the disjunction between GDP growth in the US, which has been more robust than just about anywhere in the world. Inflation in the US has come down quicker and to a lower level than just about anywhere in the world. We have more or less full employment in this country, and wages at the lower end of the spectrum have actually grown. But at the same time, people can't imagine being able to afford buying a house. People are paying twice what they did for eggs. That's a daily experience of economic stress and affordability stress that's pretty profound. And then if you layer on top of that the sense of social dislocation that's existed over the last few years, a candidate who says, I'm going to smash the system and I'm going to fix it, versus a candidate who says, I'm going to make the system maybe work a little bit better, seems to have presented people with what felt like a clear choice to many of them.
Wasn't that Harris's weakness in a way? I'm not sure that she distinguished herself from Biden enough. I'm not sure she was able to say, well, apart from the abortion issue, that she was able to say, well, yes, this is your lived experience. And yes, I am part of this administration, but this is what I will bring as a new candidate to a new administration.
No, she really struggled with that. It wasn't until about 3 weeks ago or a month ago that she actually said, I'm not Joe Biden. And she didn't really manage to set out her store. She announced some policies, although her campaign was so short that this also happened pretty late. So she announced, for example, a policy to have a $25,000 credit towards the purchase of your first home, which one would have thought was quite popular. But she didn't really make a case. And she didn't – Trump really said him, even though he's surrounded by billionaires and most of his policies are about, tax cuts for billionaires and goosing the economy that way, cutting regulation. He presented himself as breaking things and overhauling them in a way that would benefit ordinary people. And she didn't manage to set out a more popular or populist economic vision from the left or the center left. Instead, she was pretty mealy-mouthed, frankly, about business and corporate issues, and seemed to be trying to keep on side some wealthy donors rather than really articulating a vision.
Would you say, I mean, I don't know. I think not just Harris, but the Democrats didn't play their cards right. Allowing Biden to stay as long as he did, I think, for me, was quite unfortunate. So in a way, one wonders whether anybody was going to make it. You would have to be quite spectacular to do well with the little time that she had. And why is it that they were not able to, first of all, call it sooner with Biden? And also make sure that whoever the candidate is, you know, was well supported well in advance. In a way, for me, it was always going to be difficult for anyone to, with the little time that they had, to go up against anyone for that matter from the Republican side.
I think that's absolutely right. Once they waited as long as they did to act on Biden's unpopularity and his apparent, like the apparently real challenges of his age, they left themselves with a very, very narrow set of options to respond. And then having no kind of primary process, no kind of testing, there presumably, you know, wasn't really time, but it meant that they couldn't test any of the messaging. They couldn't test any of the policy platforms. So you had a candidate who sort of emerged as a vacuum or as a cipher. And people had to figure out what she meant, and she had to figure out a message in this very, very brief period. And so that was always going to be a huge struggle. Frankly, I think this is something that the Democrats have struggled with repeatedly. Mm-hmm. The idea that it was Hillary Clinton's turn in 2016, and she turned out to be a bad choice. That was the institutional leadership of the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
And, you know, you very much saw that repeated towards the end of Biden's term, where the sheer inertia and the sense that this choice belonged to him meant that they weren't able to respond to what they should have been able to see in terms of big pressures building around their popularity.
Am I right in saying they, even after, you know, we knew that now Harris is in the running, they still didn't know how to manage Biden? Biden still put his foot in it, even, you know, after the fact. And in a way, I think, compromised this race quite a bit.
I mean, he certainly didn't help. And you could see Kamala Harris trying to run from that when he, you know, made... He's been famous for gaffes for many years. Some of that is because of his stutter. Some of that is just because of his personality and style. And he had some pretty bad ones. I don't think those necessarily such a big role in the outcome. People were pretty tolerant of gaffes on both sides. I think what may have played more of a role is that they decided that they were going to try to build a coalition of wealthier, more educated, whiter voters, and that they could win in the suburbs, and that they could win over Republicans who were disaffected by or put off by Trump. So Kamala Harris campaigned more with Liz Cheney than she did with any other surrogates, you know, and surrogates who might have mobilized more of the working class vote, more of the immigrant vote. And we saw those constituencies are the ones that really swung heavily towards Trump.
So let's talk about Trump a bit and the kind of support he got from the Latina vote, which I think was a bit of a surprise. I think people started seeing that with the polls, but quite a big surprise. And also the rural vote, where you got a lot of support coming out in their numbers for him. And in fact, actually voting, not only just voting for him, but voting. And also him gaining a popular vote. And I think that's quite something.
Yeah, this is the first time that Democrats have lost the popular vote since George W. Bush won in 2004. And, you know, if you think of that moment, that was a, you know, year and a half after, a little more, 2 years after 9/11, when the country was embroiled in wars. So that's a pretty striking repudiation. We've, you know, we've spoken to a bunch of immigrant voters across New York City, mm. supposedly a Democratic stronghold, mm-hmm. Including many Latino immigrants. Mm. And of course, some of them said they were voting for Harris, but quite a few of them told us that they wanted to see change on the economy. Mm. And they also said that they felt like more recently arrived immigrants were getting better treatment and more benefits than they were. Mm. And they thought that was unfair. And one woman even said that, you know, her sister was undocumented, but hadn't been reliant on government benefits and was a hardworking person. And she thought they would be okay. And she hoped she wasn't wrong. So, and I think that is a sentiment that you would have seen replicated, you know, in a lot of places where the Latino vote swung towards Trump. People are experiencing the same pressures as the rest of the working class. And were receptive to some of the same messaging. And the Democrats didn't really have a plan for that, except that they thought, make it up in more affluent and educated areas. And in fact, the only section of the vote that swung towards Kamala was people who earn more than $100,000 a year.
If we look outside of the American borders for a minute, and I think, you know, Trump alluded to this in a way for some time, could he be the person to at least get, you know, Russia and Ukraine talking again?
I don't know whether he has the credibility in Europe or with Ukraine to do that, because he's seen as so in the tank for Putin and his interests. But I have seen some Ukrainians, you know, say that they are trading a slow death under the current policy for a huge degree of uncertainty under Trump. And, you know, he has positioned himself as that kind of leader before. If you recall, he said that he was going to, you know, make peace with North Korea and spectacularly failed. So I'm not super optimistic about that, but it'll certainly bring a massive change in the dynamic, and the Ukrainians' knowledge that they won't be able to rely on any further U.S. support is certainly going to change the calculus there, and I think importantly affect the calculus in Europe as well.
And the reason I bring this up is exactly to your point. You know, he's been quite clear about the fact that funding is going to dry up very quickly as soon as he comes in. And I wonder, with Europe itself being a bit fatigued with supporting Ukraine, there may then be a need to sit down eventually and gather, you know, the two and maybe forcefully, but maybe have them talk, because there's very little options that Ukraine may have, especially with Europe itself now focusing on other things. And perhaps that's from the angle I'm looking at this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's possible. I mean, Europe obviously feels very much more exposed to the pressure of Russian proximity than the US does.
Yeah.
And recently, European countries have actually been sending more money than the US to Ukraine, but that's not enough. So who could mediate or broker or manage such a process? I'm not sure, and I'm not sure if Trump can or his team will be able to. But it definitely puts a lot more weight on the scales in the direction of some kind of negotiation.
So if we then have to look at his administration, which I think is going to be interesting, we now know his new BFF is Elon Musk. You know, the nuts and bolts of actually governing are going to be interesting. We know that his previous administration, he didn't treat his staff very well. People left quite disgruntled and all of that. It may be a bit tough. Yes, maybe politically he may be quite popular within the Republicans, but it may be a bit tough to get a well-oiled machine, the back office, to help him. What's your thought on that?
I think that two things can be true at once. And the one thing is that, yes, his management style, his personality, his expectation of absolute loyalty, all of these things will bring what is now a familiar kind of chaos into government. But it's also true that he is coming in much more prepared this time. You know, last time it was a surprise that he won, and he kind of cobbled together a cabinet and managed to inject some allies into senior administrative positions. This time around, you know, they've drawn up lists of all of the civil servants they want to fire, the people they want to replace them with. Yeah. And this agenda has been very clearly mapped out by the Heritage Foundation in Project 2025 and by some allied groups. And I think it's also true that there are lots of those bureaucrats who kind of held the line last time who are exhausted or who have quit. So I think that there is a chance that there will be a more effective implementation of his agenda or of the Heritage Foundation's agenda this time around. And if he also has more unified control of government, we're still waiting to see what happens with the House. That's a really, really key domino. But if he has unified control of government, you now have a Supreme Court, executive branch, the Senate, and possibly the House all aligned behind his agenda. And so I think that's going to make a huge difference.
So he's, in my view, he's got a very limited time to hold it together because, you know, it's his last term. It will only be one term. He will never have a second term. Maybe 2 years really to really get everybody to rally behind him. And then the Republicans are going to start moving their focus maybe after 2 years when the midterms come through. Your thoughts on how he's going to hold it together for the entire term?
Yeah, I mean, he's going to do a lot of stuff that's going to turn out to be really unpopular, I think. And so if he really starts rounding people up and deporting them, this might be naive on my part, but I think that's going to be unpopular. I think if he implements tariffs and we see a spike in inflation, that'll be unpopular. If he runs up the deficit, which will mean interest remain higher, that will be deeply unpopular. So how he calibrates all of those actions relative to maintaining his popularity, which he cares about more than anything else, will be very interesting to see. But he does have a cadre of pretty extreme and pretty strategic people behind him now who will look to carry through that agenda. And you have J.D. Vance as the vice president. So you're right that he will become more of a lame duck after two and a half years, and we'll see what happens in the midterm elections in 2026. But he can get a lot done by executive fiat as well, you know, in the initial period. So it's a little bit of an open question how the Democrats get their act together and the rest of civil society gets its act together to respond will also be important to how that plays out. But I think this time around, his first 2 years, he will be a lot more effective than he was last time.
When we look at Harris, one didn't get the impression that there was immediate support for her. You know, it came in quite late, meaning that they were not sure themselves as the Democrats whether this is the right person. So, in other words, she wasn't that popular within the the Democratic Party. Then she comes in, and then, of course, unfortunately, she loses. Do you think this is it for her political career?
I think it probably is. The fact that she, I think one of her real weaknesses was that she wasn't seen as having any agenda of her own. You know, she was a pretty law and order Attorney General of California. Then in 2019, 2020, she was very progressive. And now in 2024, she tacked much more conservative and centrist. And the sense that she is not a politician with very strong values or policy positions or beliefs. People didn't feel like she was representing anything they could align with other than keeping Trump out and maybe protecting reproductive rights, very, very important as that is. So, yes, I think that that it probably is the end for her. And at a larger level, the choice that the Democratic Party has to make is if they want to keep chasing rightwards, or if they decide that actually what people are looking for is not more conservatism or more liberalism, but a willingness to respond to what people feel are their most urgently needed economic answers and life answers.
I think generally everybody could almost say that Biden had strong policies, a strong economy. Yes, maybe he couldn't articulate that well enough for the common man on the in the street. But, you know, by and large, I think he had a good thing going, except obviously for the missteps at the end. How do you think history will judge him?
That's a very, very interesting question. And I think that he had he, as you suggested, you know, stepped down after his first term and there'd been an open primary and a, you know, more competitive process, he would have been remembered as the guy who delivered the country from Donald Trump and implemented these huge programs to address climate and have the economy recover. I think right now this is a prediction that could well be wrong,
yes.
But what he's going to be remembered for is hanging on too long, not knowing when it was his time to go, for foreign policy disaster, particularly in the Middle East, and for having one term and letting the country slip into this situation. So even though by some measures he's had a quite successful presidency,
Yeah.
I think he's going to be remembered based on this outcome.
Wow, isn't that interesting? How do Democrats crawl back from all of this? I'm not even sure they know now. I mean, the world is not sure who their constituency really is. You spoke a little bit about the elites, which I think they did very well there, but it's certainly not working. That's not enough to run a country. How do you think they're going to claw back now?
There's a fierce battle underway already to analyze this result and to try to chart a new course. And there are people whose argument is going to be that they need to be much more populist from the left and adopt the kinds of policies that a Bernie Sanders or an Elizabeth Warren would have called for, or someone like Joe Biden's trade commissioner, Lina Khan, which are breaking up corporate monopolies, raising tax rates on the wealthy, increasing the child tax credit and other forms of social support for people who are struggling, raising the minimum wage, and so on, and who feel that if they had confidently pursued that kind of vision and agenda, they would have done much better this time around. Then there are very powerful institutional interests in the party which are going to say, well, clearly people wanted us to be more moderate, and people are worried about crime and immigration and inflation, so we need to be, you know, more hawkish on the budget, and we need to have stronger law and order crackdowns and tougher borders. And that temptation in the party is very powerful. So I think you're going to see those two groups really fight it out. And there'll also be a fight over whether they made a mistake by prioritizing identity, race, gender, sexuality over class. And so that over the coming months and years is going to consume the different factions of the Democratic Party.
And maybe in the end, Kamala Harris was too sophisticated and Trump was a guy you could have a beer with, even though he doesn't drink, but seemed like it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether I would want to have a beer with him. I think he would yell at you all night and you'd leave like slightly bored and beat up. But she certainly didn't. There were people whom she connected with, but certainly something I saw among my own progressive to liberal circles in New York is that the enthusiasm that she generated at the beginning when it was going to be like brat summer and everyone was coconut pilled, as she tacked towards the center and as she tried to build this Republican aligned coalition, the air just kind of went out of the balloon of that enthusiasm.
And maybe she's just not a great politician. Politicians are not necessarily good people. They're just good politicians. And maybe we need to get that around our heads, you know?
And she might have been a good politician, you know, to be a senator from California. You have to be a good politician to do that in some sense.
Yeah.
But it's not the same thing as a nationwide, as building a nationwide vote behind you at all.
So let me ask you a little bit of a personal question. Now that you're in the US, are you a bit nervous?
I am. I'm nervous on a few different fronts. Professionally, you know, Trump has made it very clear that he will try to crack down on the press. And he's got a lot of different levers to do that through. The US has very strong legal protections for the press, but they could be compromised by the very conservative Supreme Court that we have now. He can intervene more commercially in terms of approving mergers and acquisitions. He could use the U.S. has quite a draconian old law on the books called the Espionage Act, which he could use against journalists. And so I think we're going to see – we saw a bit of this in his first term, and I think we'll see more pressures on the press. Of course, that's the world that I work in, and I work in the nonprofit press. So I'm worried about that. You know, I have a daughter, and while abortion rights and reproductive autonomy are protected in New York State by the state constitution, clearly I'm concerned about an environment in which leaders are willing to trade away women's rights and their control over their bodies to old men and the courts. So, you know, those are troubling. And I think also that, you know, we'll see a continuing closing of the world. And I think for all of us who move in a connected world and in a world where we try to build solidarity and international connection, that is going to be difficult. And then the last thing I'll say, and this is very personal, is, you know, I remember growing up under apartheid and having the TV on at night and P.W. Botha wagging his finger and ranting at you and having people, having the constant intrusion of the most awful kind of politics into your daily life all the time. And that was a bit what it was like under Trump's first term. And I think that, you know, I'm sure many other South Africans here feel this way, is that it will feel a bit like going back to that. And it's not something we want to relive.
Nick, I really appreciate you giving us your time this evening. And Nick Dawes is an executive director of The City. It's a news outlet in New York.
Many people have told me that God spared my life for a reason. And that reason was to save our country and to restore America to greatness. And now we are going to fulfill that mission together. We're going to fulfill that mission. The task before us will not be easy, but I will bring every ounce of energy, spirit, and fight that I have in my soul to the job that you've entrusted to me. This is a great job. There's no job like this. This is the most important job in the world. Just as I did in my first term, we had a great first term, a great, great first term. I will govern by a simple motto: promises made, promises kept. We're going to keep our promises. Nothing will stop me from keeping my word to you, the people. We will make America safe, strong, prosperous, powerful, and free again. And I'm asking every citizen all across our land to join me in this noble and righteous endeavor. That's what it is. It's time to put the divisions of the past 4 years behind us. It's time to unite. And we're going to try. We're going to try. We have to try. And it's going to happen. Success will bring us together. I've seen that. I've seen that. I saw that in the first term when we became more and more successful. People started coming together. Success is going to bring us together, and we are going to start by all putting America first. We have to put our country first for at least a period of time. We have to fix it, because together we can truly make America great again for all Americans. So I want to just tell you what a great honor this is. I want to thank you. I will not let you down. America's future will be bigger, better, bolder, richer, safer and stronger than it has ever been before. God bless you and God bless America. Thank you very much.
Well, there you have it. The man of the moment, Donald Trump. America will be richer, safer, better. Do you believe that? How much do you believe this is a win for Americans? Let me hear from you. 086-000-00959. What's your take on what's happened in the U.S.? Donald Trump coming back to the White House. Yeah, it's the Trump era. Gugumfuphi, who has been with us throughout this entire time, in the thick of it, in the U.S., comes to us live this evening. Gugu, I think you haven't slept. Has it been 24 hours straight now? Hi.
No. We managed to sneak in just a few more hours of rest, because we did get back quite late last night at about 2, 3 a.m. Following the Republican watch party, where there was a hive of activity, celebratory mood from the Republicans. And I must tell you, Ospimelo, it was so such a contrasting experience to what we're actually witnessing now, where the neighborhood that I'm in is a heavily Democratic stronghold. Yeah. And many of the Americans and citizens here highlighting their disbelief, their shock, their dismay, and quite quite frankly, disappointment in the electoral outcome. So despite the fact that Minneapolis and the state of Minnesota in itself has made some, gains in terms of the Democratic levels of support that it has, there is a strong contingent of Republican supporters who showed up last night and certainly were very clear about their support and, pride in not only being Republican supporters, but being led by Trump.
I mean, yesterday you did mention the fact that, look, you're in a state that's very blue in a sense. And so, you know, things were calm and all of that. And it's a suburb and all of that. When people speak of their concerns and they talk about this win, what are they most concerned about on the ground?
What the key theme issues appear to be, Ospimilo, certainly have to be the economy. And I think that's right across the spectrum. I beg your pardon, for anyone who's an average American. When we initially started this trip and we were traveling to different states like Wisconsin and Iowa, even in Miami, every comment we heard was that the dollar store is no longer a dollar store. It's a dollar and a quarter. You need a lot more money to get you by in order to purchase the basic goods and services that you need in life. And what Republican supporters strongly feel is that the economy worked a lot better under Donald Trump. Then again, there were several metrics that perhaps they don't necessarily focus on when it comes to the macroeconomic environment, the geopolitical conflict that we saw, not only in parts of the Middle East, but even between Russia and Ukraine wasn't as significant at the time and didn't play an influence. But those are factors and metrics and numbers that they don't typically look at. Whereas Democratic supporters are fully understanding of the fact that we live in a global society and that the external factors that impact their livelihoods and experience on a day-to-day experience. But one thing that certainly stood with me yesterday when I spoke to a few Republican supporters is that they essentially just want to protect the income in their pockets, protect the livelihoods of their children, and what they believe is a way of having a sense of control over that is by having a more conservative approach where Americans put Americans first and prioritize their well-being through the win and the victory of Donald Trump being the president again. So those are some of the bread and butter issues. It's just about feeling as though there's a sense of control and autonomy over their lives without feeling as though they have others impeding over their flexibility and freedom.
When you look at the kinds of people who voted for Harris, these are more affluentish people. These are more educated people. And in a way, one wonders whether the Democrats were not too aloof, whether not too far away from the real lived experiences of the people that voted for Trump, who on a daily basis have to think about the cost of living, who on a daily basis have to compete with incoming foreigners for jobs and all of that, who maybe would understand his rhetoric. Not because they don't understand what the Democrats are saying, but because these are things that directly affect them on a daily basis. The crime that people speak of in border states, you know, the drugs and all of that stuff. For people who, even as they themselves are foreigners, who speak of, well, when we came in legally, and right now things are a bit of a mess. Quite reminiscent of South Africans, isn't it?
Right.
And who, even as they identify with the color and the gender of the people who are crossing the border, they still themselves see America as theirs, and they still themselves want better security.
That is a very valid point. And this, I think, comes to the fore in terms of some of the parts of the experience that I've had in the U.S. Just last night, looking at the Republican Party, I must tell you, from a very personal point of view, Pumelo, I was in the minority. I was probably one of three black females there, all of whom were actually not African-American. There was a Mexican-American woman and a Somali-American woman that was in the room. And when I engaged with them, they essentially mentioned similar factors that, look, we don't mind that they want to tighten up immigration controls. They should, because there are too many people here. So there's a direct classification, I guess, of the socioeconomic standing that does exist, that they don't mind immigration controls being tighter under Trump. And that's part of the reason why they don't clearly relate very well to the Democrats. Same experience also took place when I was in Chicago. I had the opportunity to actually pay a visit to what is described as Obama's previous home before he moved into presidency. Beautiful home within a suburban neighborhood, highly affluent, not too far from the University of Chicago. And one can sense that there is a sense of affluence that does exist. Mm. I paradox that with the conversation I had with the Uber driver on my return back to the city, who black people for a ride, that there hasn't been an adequate sense of inclusion and participation to actually shift and alter their lives. He was even very critical of the leadership of Barack Obama during his particular time as president, essentially saying that there was a lot of support, a strong view that he would shift the experience for African Americans and other people of color, but that didn't fully translate as there was an aspect of the educated versus the uneducated and the blue-collar workers within the American environment. And similar experience also took place when we visited a prison called San Quentin in San Francisco, where again, much of the rhetoric from the black males who were in prison, again, making up the large majority. And as we know, if you look at the history of American prison systems, there is a heightened level of people of color and African-American men, unfortunately, finding themselves being arrested from a very early age and essentially being stuck in a system where the probabilities of them remaining in prison are a lot higher. Much of the conversations we had in the prison and even with people outside of the prison was, again, a strong sense of a disconnect that they felt from Kamala Harris. Also doesn't help that her background as a prosecutor working in the Bay Area at the time also saw her working against and prosecuting a lot of black males. So you're right, there is a socioeconomic dynamic. It might not even be racial anymore, but to a certain extent really viewed as a sense of classicism. And people still feeling ostracized and excluded as a result, unable to adequately relate with the Democrats.
You know, I wonder what will it take for the Democrats now to rally support and to, I suppose, get the state like where you are right now, feeling secure again, because we've all been waiting for Harris to concede. It's not happening. I think she's still, I don't know, having a dopey or something, but she's obviously not okay where she is. Donald Trump called her a drunk. So, you know, whatever the case may be, do you get the sense that a lot of Americans are despondent about where the Democrats are right now?
I definitely get that sense, again, because I'm in a very stronghold within the Democrat environment. What I have also picked up, Pimelo, is that I guess the level of support that Democrats typically do see are from people who themselves are not only liberal, but also have a heightened worldview and understand how America plays an influence in the rest of the world and how the world also influences dynamics within the U.S. And that's very different from many of the Republican supporters who are individuals who haven't necessarily stepped out of their counties, never mind their states. So their own unique experience is their view of the world. And that's what they prioritize without having a deeper and fuller perspective and comprehension of dynamics that might not be lived experiences on their part. There is, I guess, a concern of, you know, what does this mean for the Democrats going forward? Yeah. How will they relate to society as well as more Americans, especially as many have actually provided a lot of analysis that Americans are looking to go back to a realm of conservative. And also criticizing, I guess, how Kamala Harris might not have brought about a different narrative to the Biden presidency. So it was deemed as though she was living under his shadow and nothing would fundamentally change upon her new leadership. From a personal perspective, I must say it's very complex and it's an interesting one to observe because it, I think, gives us an inside view into the psychology, not only of human beings overall, but one of the most diverse countries in the world. It's just in terms of how it is that at one point we actually looked at this democracy as a beacon and a great example of what democracy should be. And that potentially it might still be the example, but still leading to so many diverse views and experiences that could actually heighten levels of conflict that might not have surfaced into, I guess, physical altercations just yet. But just looking at the divisive opinions and views and experiences of Americans, it brings about a very, very sometimes confusing aspect to try to understand more about the society.
You know, I know this is not big news at the moment, but there were murmurs earlier that maybe the Russians were busy fiddling and fidgeting. I'm just curious just to what extent that's been covered in the US.
That has been covered in the US in particular, where there were concerns about, I believe it was a bomb scare in, mm-hmm. in other parts of the country, and how there were concerns of a link to related to Russia there. There have been reports of that. Looking at the mainstream media, though, mm-hmm. I must say that hasn't been reported on too heavily. They have still maintained their focus largely on the results, on the outcomes, on the economic consequences and geopolitical consequences. Social media, though, which has also been a growing source of information for a lot of Americans, is where I believe a lot of aspects of disinformation and misinformation certainly penetrate the market. And this is typically where we've also seen deep fake videos, deep fake audio clips being released of certain murmurings taking place. This also does raise concerns, because I do believe that it will take, few levels of investigation and deeper, evaluation of some of this content before this clear understanding and clarity of any potential external influence, much like we've seen in the past, where there has been fake news deliberately and intentionally spewed out into the market. It might just take a little bit longer for us to fully interrogate that.
So what's his name? Elon Musk is now the BFF of all time now. Trump mentioned him personally today, saying, he said, a star is born. So clearly, and I think there was, he alluded to the fact that he may have a place in his government. Your take on that?
This has been the underlying sentiment. Many people have asked this question, that should Trump win, will Elon Musk have a place within his government? Some have said, well, yes, maybe. Others have said, maybe not directly. But we cannot deny the fact that Elon Musk is a very influential person, not only within the politics through his support for Donald Trump, but he's got interests at hand here. He is leading one of the largest investments in terms of technology, whether it's the data network connectivity, whether it's Tesla or other investments that he does have going on. And what we do find is that a lot of technology company owners are trying to find a way to work directly with regulators to actually manipulate or influence the legal structures that will control the laws that govern the businesses that they own. So there's a direct interest and conflict that does take place there. Some have actually said, hold on, Elon is still a businessman. He doesn't have the time to necessarily sit in Congress and sit with other lawmakers, and might actually feel bored by that experience. But it doesn't negate the fact that this does give him, direct access to having an influence over the rules and regulations that will shape the technology industry and much of Silicon Valley going forward. So he might not necessarily get a title, but I don't think that takes away the influence that he might have.
By and large, Gugu, I think the media was pro-Harris, by and large. And I wonder now. We know how Trump has always dealt with the media. In fact, very recently, I think yesterday, he called out another journalist who asked him about whether, his supporters need to be spoken to. And he was quite scathing of the journalist, saying, well, I don't like your question type thing. Is there a bit of nervousness in the air with journalists just, reporting on Trump and the kind of, he's erratic, as we know, and shoots from the hip and is not necessarily always pleasant when he speaks to journalists. And we've seen that over time. What's the mood like with the media with regards to covering Donald Trump?
100%. I can confirm you are very right that the media did have a strong level of support for behind Harris, and perhaps might not have endorsed her outrightly, despite some broadcast institutions not working in that manner, but there has been a leaning towards her support. The journalists that we've spoken to, not only journalists and media professionals within organizations like CNN and CBS, but also institutions where they, educational institutions and academia, have also highlighted a concern of decreased democracy and safety of media professionals. Mm. Some have actually said that they have considered finding alternative means of providing a level of support for media professionals who are typically at the front line as White House reporters or political reporters who would engage with Donald Trump. Mm. Others even saying that this might be more of a challenge when it comes to broadcast journalism. Mm-hmm. But print, they are actually looking at removing bylines. So that there's a sense of anonymity when a lot of reporters are reporting on any stories that might be related to Donald Trump. But then again, America, as we know, is a very small if, though it's a big society. So there are concerns about freedom and media freedom. And I think that's an interesting shift in turning the tide, right? Mm. The participation and the base of the fellowship that I'm in at the moment was really set on the ethos that America is the beacon of hope when it comes to press freedom. And media freedom. And now it almost appears as
look
though,
at you, you now. Know, are we different. Don't you miss us already? Don't you miss us already?
Well, and that's a very valid point, Pimelo. Even the mood, I guess, amongst many of us as journalists, because we represent much of the global south, mm-hmm. India, Brazil, Peru, mm-hmm. Finland is also present, Ukraine, mm-hmm. And many of the economies that we do represent have all highlighted it. To a large extent, yes, we do respect the outcomes of the democratic elections that have taken place here in the U.S., but there has always been an understanding that a democratic government in the U.S. would have greater leanings and, I guess, an approach and experience with foreign policy and international relations. So much of the feedback that I've been hearing from my colleagues and fellows here has also been one with a heightened level of anxiety mm-hmm. back in their home countries as to, whoa, what does a Trump win mean mm-hmm. for the rest of the world, including our interactions with the U.S.?
Sure. Gugu, thank you so much. Get some rest. We'll speak to you soon. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Pimelo.
That's Gugu Mfuphi, who is in Minnesota, Minneapolis, and she's been giving us rolling coverage on this election. Boy, as I said, she really hasn't slept, I'd say, for the past 20 hours. She's been taking little naps here and there, but really appreciate her giving us, you know, her insights. And it's really important to get a sense of what's happening on the ground. So really appreciate it, Gugu Mfuphi, who's going to be back soon, by the way. So she'll be back in a hot seat as usual on Kayabiz.
If you missed it live, catch the podcast on kaya959.co.za.